Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Nasike nirvidyetam dojuyati nabhasvati tatra ayur gandha vaho grano nasi jigrikshata Nasike nirabhidyetam dojuyati nabhasvati tatra vayur gandhavaho grano nasi jigrikshata nasike nirabhidyetam dojuyati nabhasvati tatra vayur gandhavaho grano nasi jigrikshata nasike nirabhidyetam dojuyati nabhasvati tatra vayur gandhavaho grano nasi jigrikshata Nasike, in the nostrils. Nirabhidyetam, being developed. Dojuyati, rapidly blowing. Navasvati, air respiration. Tatra, thereupon. Vayu, air. Gandhavaha, smelling odor. Grana, sense of smell. Nasi, in the nose. Jigrikshata, desiring to smell odors. Thereafter, when the Supreme Purusha desired to smell odors, the nostrils and respiration were generated. The nasal instrument and odors came into existence, and the deity and the controlling deity of air carrying smell also became manifest. Purport. The nasal instrument, odor, and the controlling deity air, smelling, etc., all became manifested simultaneously when the Lord desired to smell. The Vedic mantras confirm this statement in the Upanishad statement that everything is first desired by the Supreme before the subordinate living entity can act upon it. The living entity can see only when the Lord sees. The living entity can smell when the Lord smells, and so on. The idea is that the living entity cannot do anything independently. He can simply think of doing something independently, but he cannot act independently. This independence in thinking is there by the grace of the Lord, but the thinking can be given shape by the grace of the Lord. And therefore, the common saying is that man proposes and God disposes. The whole explanation is on the subject of the absolute dependence of the living entities and absolute independence of the Supreme Lord. Less intelligent persons claiming to be on an equal level with God must first prove themselves to be absolute and independent, and then they must substantiate the claim to being one with God. So establishing here that the Supreme Lord, he is actually doing everything. Because we have this element that the living entity is doing so many things and they feel they are doing that on their own, independently. But actually, the living entity is only able to do these things because of the Lord's presence. and because of the Lord's doing these things. And the Lord desires to do these things manifest, and when he is not interested, then all this stops. Right? This is what we call the dissolution. Right? Generally we take it, it's the time factor. And so there's a mechanics in motion, and so the creation happens, and then the dissolution happens. But the actual working principle is the Lord's desire. He wants to taste, he wants to interact, so there's creation. When he's not interested anymore, there's dissolution. Right? Does this make sense? Right? So it brings it into this personal aspect, that it's all going on because of the Lord. So the Lord is seeing, the Lord is smelling, the Lord is touching, the Lord is tasting, he's doing all these things. Now, that ability to do those same sensual activities is awarded to the living entity. But he needs to do it according to the Lord's direction. Right? If it's done without the Lord's direction, then a problem arises. Because it is the Lord who is smelling, touching, tasting, and doing all these things. Does that make sense? Right? He's doing these things through the universal form. In other words, that potency of smell is there. And because he is smelling, everybody else can smell. Now, how you want to use that smell, that's there. That's up to you. Right? Right? The father makes money. Therefore, there's money in the house. Now, the children in the house, therefore, they have money. Right? It would be foolish to say, oh, it's their money. No, it's only in the house because the father's created it. Now the child can either spend that money in a way that the father would approve of and therefore develop nicely his relationship with the father and his, you know, maturity and so many other good qualities, or he can use it how he wants. Right? And to do that, you basically have to ignore the father. Does that make sense? So that's the thing, is the senses are part of the universal form. And so the Lord is smelling, and he smells what he likes to smell. But the senses can be used to smell whatever you like, whatever you would like to smell. Right? So there's 8,400,000 options of smell. And you can smell whichever ones you like. Does that make sense? So that will, and depending upon that, then the controlling deity will arrange it. So we're bringing out the thing of the adiatmak, adidaivak, adibhautik, is that there's always the deity in control who actually is running the things. Then there is the objects of the senses, and there's the living entity that receives all that, or who thinks that they are the doer. This makes sense? All right? So we're trying to point this, we're trying to understand is that we are separate. The soul is adiatmak, right? The atma that is perceiving all this. The body, the senses, this is the adibhautik. It's the instrument, what is happening. And then the adidaivak, that's the one that actually carries out the function, right? Does this make sense? So then in this way we can understand it's not actually us. Our only independence is what we desire. Right? That's being brought out. This independence in thinking is the Lord's grace. He is independent, so we're minutely independent. So now our choice is how we want to use that independence. That's what we're actually dealing with. Do we want to use that independence in connection with the Lord, or do we want to use that independence separately from the Lord? That's basically our choice. There's not some other choice. Right? Because the soul is doing nothing. The senses are interacting with the sense objects. That's being controlled by the controlling deities. And that's happening simply because of our desire. Right? Because it works so smoothly, as soon as we think it, then it functions. We think we're doing it. But it doesn't actually work like that. Right? Does that make sense? You want to move. You have a, how you say, due to the reaction of the modes of nature, then on the skin, there is a sensation, and the mind interprets that as an itch. So then we want to scratch that itch, right? Because the soul identifies with this body, therefore we want to interact with this body to make it as, you know, comfortable and pleasant as possible. So we have the desire to scratch that itch. So the controlling deity of air, which is also the controlling deity of the skin, then moves the muscles, because the muscles are actually moved by air. And then the hand moves, and then we scratch. Right? But because it happens basically, seemingly simultaneously, we think, I am doing the scratching. I desire to scratch, I am scratching. But actually, without the hand, and without the controlling deity to move the air that moves the hand, scratching does not go on. Right? Does that make sense? So this is what's actually happening. But we're thinking we're doing it. So this part of the Bhagavatam is pointing out, separating us from the body and everything around us. Right? This is not an important place to get absorbed or stuck, right? It's an important aspect to separate ourselves from material existence, right? These, technical or mechanical techniques that are used within the Vedic science of self-realization, they're very useful and they're recommended, but only for that purpose, right? They're to make us understand that we are not the body, right? That our how things work, we're not the controller, we're not the enjoyer, right? Here, the devas are the controller, and the Lord's the enjoyer, right? This is being pointed out here. So, the two reasons we do anything materially actually aren't substantiated by these verses, right? We want to control, but it's the controlling deity that's doing the control. We want to enjoy, but actually the senses are simply the manifestation of the desire of the Virat Purush. We can tap into them, right? Does that make sense? Someone else is doing something. It's basically, what is it? There's a term for it. Where you enjoy through someone else?
Vicarious.
Yeah, vicarious. So technically it's a very realistic vicarious enjoyment. Right? We're given the opportunity to actually basically experience what the other person does, which is our position. This is what we do in the spiritual world also. The jiva means Mother Jashoda serving Krishna. And she is a direct servant. Right? She is parental love for Krishna. Everyone else is actually her assistant. So her appreciation or feelings, affection she has for Krishna, those who assist her to the degree of their actual surrender to that process of assisting Mother Jashoda, they taste closer and closer what she tastes. Right? Does that make sense? So that's what the jivas do, right? That's us. So the same thing is applied here, but here it's always changing because we don't have a fixed, right? In the spiritual world, you have a fixed relationship with Krishna. But here, there is no fixed relationship, right? Because we're trying to fix ourselves. Means there it's fixed because we say we're servant. Here it's not fixed because we say I'm God. So it's not actually true. So our trying to manifest our godness then adjusts according to the situation. And so therefore different bodies, different things are there. And so then in our trying to taste that, it keeps changing from life to life. But the principle is the same. Someone else is doing the enjoyment, someone else is controlling the situation, and we're vicariously taking part. Does that make sense? But here we're doing it for our own purpose, there we're doing it for the pleasure of those we are serving. Right? It means here, we want to be involved and get as close as possible because we want to get as much as we can get out of it. Right? The spiritual world, we want to get, whatever is appropriate for our situation. We want to serve because that will expand the pleasure that that servant can give to Krishna. Does that make sense? Right? You have a nice meal and you add into it some condiments. Right? So that enhances a meal. It doesn't. We don't take the condiments as its own meal. Right? No one sits down with a little nice little plate of salt and pepper and a green chili and some lemon achar and goes, "Wow, hey, great meal." Right? No. It adds something to a meal that already exists. Right? So that's us. We can add. So that's for those persons' pleasure. Krishna's pleasure for his devotees' pleasure. So we add something. While here, we try to make the whole meal out of that little condiment plate. And then, according to our karma, we're getting something or not. Right? So, the living entity, basically, then these things are to break our idea that we're the controller and enjoyer by seeing that we're not. We're not the body. We're not the one controlling anything. We're not actually the enjoyer of the whole thing. And so then the question is, what are we doing here? Because these desires and needs are there because they're inherent in the living entity. Right? Means chit indicates activity. Ananda indicates some pleasure is achieved. Right? Sat means that there's some situation in which those other two are happening. So that's natural. So then the question comes up, I'm doing these things, but then if this isn't the real thing, then where is the real thing? What should I actually be doing? How should I be using my independence to take part in this process of there being the adhyatmic, adhidaivic, and adhibhautik? What am I actually supposed to be doing? So then that brings us to Krishna. Krishna and his devotees and his pastimes. Does that make sense? So these are tools to be used to get out of the material world, to get out of material consciousness. And they're never to be focused upon. If they're focused upon, it will create a problem. It may be a little bit more subtle of a problem than our previous problems. We're interested in liberation, we're interested in jnana, but still it's a problem. It will keep us here. We won't get out of the material world. Right? So it's important to use. So these things, it's important to find this balance that we can work with things without actually getting attached to them. Right? So, but Krishna points out in the Gita that actually that's a quality of the living entity. Krishna can work with anything and not be attached because he is independent. But the living entity, whatever he works with, he becomes attached to. So then it becomes a problem. So we're attached to material energy, so that's not good. But attachment is what we are. So what are we going to do? So we take this material energy, means so we should be attached to Krishna. But being attached to Krishna is something real. It's not something we just decide on. Right? We decide intellectually, we make that endeavor, we use our independence, then that attachment grows by association. It's described in the Shastra that there's different kinds of attachment. So one is spontaneous, that's the best. But if you don't have spontaneous attachment, then by properly associating with others, you know, appropriate association with others will develop attachment. Right? Does that make sense? So, if someone you're supposed to be working with, and you work with them how you're supposed to work, things will run smoothly. So because it runs smoothly, the living entity becomes attached. Does that make sense? Right? So, therefore, if we don't surrender by hearing about Krishna's wonderful qualities, we don't immediately surrender to him out of that affection, that spontaneous attraction, then, through intelligence, we can follow the process of sadhana bhakti. And then, through that, associate with Krishna and his devotees in an appropriate way. That will develop that attachment until it comes to the point where it becomes spontaneous. Does that make sense? So, because we're trying to switch from the material attachment to the spiritual, and because the living entity is attached, you can't just give it up, then this process is given, is that what you are attached to materially, you actually dismantle, and you understand how it's actually Krishna. And so if it's Krishna, then whatever is the best of that, you want to offer to Krishna. That's why we offer the best. Right? Because it's actually Krishna who is the one who's going to experience it. So the best that we can arrange, the best within our ability, that's offered. But it's the devotion that's important, because what we're trying to get to is attachment. Does this make sense? But not attachment here, attachment there. So we can see is that that process of becoming aware of our misplaced attachment, and the process of dovetailing that misplaced attachment so it actually connects to Krishna, it's an important part of devotional service, but it itself is not something that we become attached to. Does that make sense? So we're attaching ourselves to Krishna, so therefore attachments there, we can act. We will act. But the medium through which we're using, that we avoid the attachment to. Does that make sense? Because even in the spiritual world, the residents of Vrindavan aren't attached to the facilities of Vrindavan. Right? That's important. In Vaikuntha, they're very impressed by the facilities of Vaikuntha. So they're more attached to the Lord, of course. But in Vrindavan, it's so much more opulence, and there's so much greater facilities there, but it's just something you use for Krishna. Does that make sense? So it's just how we work. It's that the reason that we would be favorable towards a situation or certain facilities is because of its how nicely it works for Krishna. Does that make sense? You have a tree. Whatever you need to serve Krishna with, you ask the tree, it will give you. Right? So, therefore, is it the tree that we're supposed to be attached to or impressed by? Or is it the service to Krishna? Right? That's why, even though Vrindavan is unlimitedly more opulent than Vaikuntha, it's never discussed, because nobody cares. Right? This is in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. We see a discussion between Ramananda Raya and Swarup Damodar and Srivas Pandit. Because Srivas Pandit, being Narad Muni, he's a Vaikuntha man. So he's saying, my Vaikuntha is so nice, it's so opulent, it's so this, it's so that. And your Vrindavan is just some trees and some sticks and some cows, and that's it. So Swarup Damodar points out that all the opulence, that dust that all the cows are walking around and kicking around in the air, each one of those grains is Chintamani, and Chintamani is the source of the opulence of Vaikuntha. Right? So, therefore, but nobody cares there. The cows can give everything, anything you would want, but they only ask for some milk. Right? The trees could give anything you want, and they only asked for some fruit, some flowers. Because they have nothing else other than to please Krishna. That's their only purpose. Does that make sense? So, the attachment to the medium, the facility, is not the focus. Right? Does that make sense? It means these external things, these kind of things. The relationships, the devotees, the Lord, yes. Anything to do with relationship, that is. But the facilities that help that relationship, support that relationship, those aren't the things that we're attached to. Does that make sense? So in the same principle is in operating the material energy so that we can convert it to giving us a spiritual result, by engaging under the control of yoga maya instead of mahamaya, by using this connection with the universal form, it is also something we use, but we do not become enamored by it. Right? Does that make some sense? We just use it. Right? Some guests came to Rome, you know, thousands of years ago when the Romans were at the height of their civilization. And they had running water in the houses. They had the aqueduct and they had pipes that go into the house, and they had a pipe coming out of the wall that I think you stuck a cork in. And when you want, you just opened it and water came out and put the cork back. So someone that was not from Rome saw this. They were so impressed. So they actually went and broke that pipe out of the wall and took it back to their village and stuck it in their wall. And they were somehow or another not as impressed with results in their village as they had been with the results that they had gained in Rome. So, but the Romans themselves, it's just something. The point is you get the water and use the water for your cooking, your cleaning and bathing and all those things. That's what's important. They're not enamored by this whole amazing, you know, system that they've just brought water from, you know, who knows how many hundreds of miles away to their city. The point is the water was used. It's amazing, but that's not, if you're amazed by it, you can't use it. Does that make sense? If you're too enamored by something, you cannot interact with it properly, appropriately. Does that make sense? Right? So therefore, on the material platform, we're very careful that we work with these things, and it's normal, right? What's the difference between someone who's an enthusiast in, let's say, an activity, someone who is an expert or a master of the activity, right? The expert and the neophyte will be basically enamored by it. One is enamored because of the mystique of it. The other is because of their ability in it. They're very proud of their ability. But the master is just normal. Does that make sense? Therefore, that's why they can deal with it the best. It's just normal. Does that make sense? Right? So, that's the whole idea, is that this technique is used and is very useful for separating us from the material entanglement, material attachment, material mentality. But it should never become actually the focus where we see that as a goal. Right? It's something that we become good at, that we use in the Lord's service. Right? And then we move on. And moving on means coming to the platform of pure unalloyed devotional service. We situate ourselves in the spiritual world. Okay. Any questions or comments on this?
Yeah. It's very about the Guru Dhamma, not discussing with the few us, and she was saying there's nothing in the Dhamma, there's just some trees and this plant of Guru Dhamma.
Why is the Gunjamala so significant? That I wouldn't know specifically. You'd have to ask somebody. Do you know why the Gunjamala is so? How is it connected with Radharani?
Generally, it's used as a messenger's paradigm, but never a message from Radharani. She makes a mala for Krishna. Generally, that's the total of Krishna from Radharani. And even he sends one back off to make a message, so it's
connected to their messages. Does that make sense? So, in other words, you could get all here? Means the Gunjamala is used as when the messengers are sent from Radharani to Krishna. So the Gunjamala is sent by Radharani, and then one is reciprocated by Krishna, because then you know that who it's from. Otherwise, the message could be anything. You know, you get a leaf with a half moon nail mark on, you know, but anybody could have sent that. So if it's, it comes with the Gunjamala, then you know who it's from. So it becomes connected with Radharani. Therefore, the Gunja becomes very dear because of its connection to Radharani. Right? So then one could say, well, how would that be important as shelter? But shelter means service. You know, shelter is not just that you do nothing. It's service. So messaging is service. So it indicates service. Is that okay? You had something, General?
In the explanation of the controlling deity, you can scratch your arm, but you can scratch him, but you don't come into no sacrifice.
Oh, okay.
So what's the relationship with the demigods and the deity? How is going to be controlled if you scratch him?
Okay, so yeah. Could you hear? Understand? I mean, the question is this. Okay, we're scratching ourselves. The example is given of the controlling being with the scratching. And so then, but at the same time, you have the mode, so it can be scratching, goodness, passion, or ignorance. So that's the element, that's our independence. Is that due to our, means that controlling deity arranges the situation according to our previous activities and according to our present. It means it's a combination of present desire and past activity. So depending upon the past activity, that will give you results, and from those results you can take, just like a banker, he has your money depending upon your results. So whatever you've given him, you can draw from. So if you put, you know, 10 rupees in the bank and you come to the teller and say, I want 100, you can't get it. But if you come and say, I want 5, you can. So the controlling deity sees what you've done before, gives you the results of that, and then depending upon what you want now, you'll get, and according to what you do now, they'll give you your future. So basically, the situation will be controlled by some modes, but that's actually not the important factor. The important factor is what you do in that situation. That will generate what the next modes will be. Because whatever you do now, that will generate the next situation. You know, what you do in the situation now, that's going to create for you future situations. And those will be controlled by the modes depending upon your consciousness at performing the activity at present. Like that. So it's a simultaneous overlap. In other words, the things from before are coming to you, and what you do with them. So the question of predestiny and free will are happening simultaneously. Free will is what you do, your choice to do with your predestiny. So whatever you've done before, that's coming to you now. What you do with it now will generate what will happen to you in the future. So you always are independent that you can decide what to do with it. You can't decide what you're going to get because that was your previous choice. Your previous independence created now. So that's just there. You order something in a restaurant, they will bring you what you ordered, generally. But, you know, so, and then if you've forgotten, you know, in that 20 minutes or, you know, longer, then you could get upset. Why are you bringing me this? I don't want this. You know, so that's where the question of the bewilderment over predestiny comes in. But no, you ordered it, so you got it. Now you can leave it on the table, you can eat it, you can throw it at each other, you can, you know, do so many things with it. That's your free will. You eat it and you leave peacefully and pay your bill, you know, you can come back there. You don't pay the bill, you throw it around the place, they'll throw you out. That's your free will. Right, and then if while they're throwing you out the door, you go, why, I don't deserve this, why am I being thrown out, I'm a nice guy, but you had your independence that you wanted to take your food and throw it around and smear it on the walls, so therefore they're throwing you out. So every moment you have your independence, what you do with it, you know. So like when they're throwing you out, you could go peacefully, understanding, or you can make a scene and they'll call the cops. So at every moment you have your independence, but the situation previously. So that's what the controlling deity does. He simply controls what you get from the past, and then depending upon your consciousness and what you do now, then he arranges the future. And the organs themselves, those are functioning by the will of the Virat Purush. Right? He wants to smell, he wants to taste. So smelling and tasting are going on. We can tap into that. Right? The river is flowing. We can go and come take some water out of it. But because the river is there, that's why we can get. The river's not there, we don't get any water. So because that's flowing, that's happening in the universe. All those energies are moving from one to the other. The senses are moving, the sense objects and everything like that. We can tap into that according to our desire that's then awarded by the controlling deity. So that's the relationship between the Adiatmak, Adidaivak, and Adibhautik. Does that make any sense?
The idea
of
the Dharma Shastra is to choose more
motive goodness. Yeah. So the idea of the Dharma Shastra is actually to choose those choices that the Lord Himself would choose. Means, in other words, you want to associate with the Lord. It means in the spiritual world you associate with the Lord because you're associating with the associates of the Lord. You're assisting the associates that know what the Lord wants. Right? So they teach, Mother Jashoda teaches what he likes to eat, how he likes to be served, what's the environment in which it's done, what ornaments he likes to wear, what clothes, how he likes to wear them, how he likes his bath, you know, how he likes to be talked to, all these different arrangements for his, you know, household arrangements, that Mother Jashoda knows. So anybody who wants to please Krishna in that way has to learn from her. So technically you could say she is the parental Dharma, she's the walking Dharma Shastra of parentalness. But in the world here, so then it's more generic because at any lifetime you could be any of these five rasas with, you know, whatever. So they're all just put down in the scriptures. So the human taste, what Krishna likes to eat, that's what the Dharma Shastra said should be eaten, and in that way that it likes to be done. Krishna likes things done according to sacrifice, right? It's like this. Something that's a little harder to get increases the taste of it. Anything too easy to get is not, the taste is less upon getting it. You may say, oh, that's what I want, but when you get it, you'll find it's not so exciting. So here you have God who, whatever he thinks, he's satya sankalpa, whatever he thinks is truth, it happens. So for him, it's fun to put restrictions in the way in him getting things. It increases the rasa. So therefore, even though God could do whatever he likes to put these things in the way so that it increases the rasa. We're trying to be God, and so these things get in the way of our being the supreme controller and enjoyer, so they're very annoying to us. But to God, they're very nice. So then we understand is that the Dharma Shastras are there because that's how God actually likes to interact with other people. Right? God, because he comes in all the forms of life and in all these different things. So your Brahma Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, they're all different forms of this life. So he comes in all these positions. So how does he do? It means, okay, he takes the position of a chariot driver. A charioteer is a Shudra. Means, right, that occupation is that of a Shudra. So, is Krishna telling Arjuna where to drive, or is Arjuna telling Krishna where to drive? Right? Because Shudras listen to who they work for. So, Arjuna says, you know, take my chariot out into the middle of the army. And Krishna says, no problem. You know, if we go out in the middle of the army, then you can see all those nice relatives and friends and well-wishers that have come here to fight with you. Right? So he's doing everything because that's how he likes to deal. Right? When he's a cowherd, then they take care of the cows and they deal, they pay their taxes and all these kind of things. Right? They're getting land. Right? The king is giving them land, the right to farm and take care of land. To reciprocate that, they want to show it, so they give the results, a portion of their results to the king. Because he's protecting them. Right? The king, he's getting advice from the Brahmins, he's getting assistance from the Shudras, so he gives things to them. He's happy for what they're doing. He's able to protect the environment that the Vaishya can function in. Because that's what they need. They need a safe environment where they can run their economics. Right? If justice is not there, you can't have economics. Right? If people just steal in this, there's no economics. Right? So there has to be a safe judicial environment for economics. So when people start actually talking morality, they're talking economics. They're not talking religion, or they're not talking devotional service. Morality is actually an element of economics. If there's no morality, you can't have economics. Does that make sense? That's why the Vaishya mentality is very attached to morality. Like that. So you see all these different things. When Krishna takes all these stations, then it's a Kshatriya, then you know, it's Ram, the rules and regulations and all those things. He likes that. Or as Brahmins, then he acts in those ways. And then he will interact with others. So as a Brahmin, how he would interact with another Brahmin, how would he interact with a Kshatriya, a Vaishya, a Shudra, you know, how him as a Brahmachari, how he interacts with the Grihasthas, Vanaprastha, Sannyasis, how as a Grihasthi interacts with the others, how as a Sannyasi he interacts. So these are all his choices of how he likes to act. So then if we want to bring ourselves in line with the residents of Vrindavan, because they know what Krishna likes and we want to assist them, then we get used to that idea by, in the material world, following the scriptures that give us how Krishna likes to interact in the social scene. So we are used to that. So then the same principle comes there. Difference being is if we're attached to the rules, that makes Vaikuntha. And if we're not attached, it's actually the rasa, then that's Vrindavan. Does that make any sense? Like that. So it's all these different things, they're actually on a very different platform than what we're doing. But if that's not there, because the Krishna's pleasure is actually the reason for doing anything, and that should be why it's done. But if it's not, then we have nice rules that it's religious. Oh, if you do this, you'll get out of the material world, right? Because if bhakti is not the main driving force, it'll be dharma, artha, kama, moksha. Right? So it's either it's good for my senses. Okay, if I deal with like this, the Kama Shastras say if I deal like this, I'll actually get more sense gratification. Right? Even though it's completely backwards from how I do it, but the Shastra says that's the way it's done. So I do it, and it works. Okay. Or if I do these things in Artha, then I will get economic growth. Or if I do these things in Dharma, then I will get very nice social, you know, interaction. And if I do these things according to the Jnana Shastras, then I will become freed from material entanglement. So we have our motive, therefore we do it. But actually it's just because that's how Krishna likes it. That's the bottom line. But if we say that, and it's kind of like, well, that's so simple, or that sounds stupid, or and that's it. You know, we want something very difficult, right? The doctor comes in, you have a very serious terminal disease, and he comes in and gives you a very nice tasting pill and says, take this, everything will be fine. You know, we'll kind of go, what's wrong here? You know, where's all the very, you know, restrictions and pain and terrible medicine and, you know, all kinds of distress and all that. You know, so they say, oh, okay, that's what you like. Okay, then instead of this nice tasting medicine you take one time, then here, you know, take this terrible tasting medicine and, you know, do all these other things, and then you feel something happen, because faith is important. So if it's just a matter of Krishna doesn't like it and that's your motive, that's all you need. But if it's not, then you have to get into the whole mechanics and metaphysics or religion or morality or just pragmatism, you know. Because then you'll say, oh, now I can value it. Now it's important. And factually, it's just, this is the way Krishna likes it. You do it this way, it's great. That should be our motive. Though we can explain it scientifically to anybody who does not function on this platform. But actually, that should be our platform of functioning, what we want to get to. Because that's what the residents of the spiritual world, it pleases Krishna, that's why they do it. Right? Krishna likes his rice, dal, and sabji, so that's why they make it. You know, he likes to tend cows, so that's why they have cows. Right? You know, he likes to go out into the forest, so therefore, that's why that's arranged. Is that okay? And that's why they do it. Right? So we see just like the example of the Krishna had a headache, and if he had the dust from the feet of his devotees, then it would make his head go away. So he went to different devotees. So the Vaikuntha Vasis, oh, you know, he may go to hell or this or that. and they're worried about all these rules. But the gopi says, yeah, take it. But aren't you worried you'll go to hell? It says to wife, going to hell makes his headache go away. Great, you know. So it's just, they're not worried about anything else. It's just, it makes Krishna happy. That's all that matters. You know, that's all. You know, that's like the, you know, you hear about these things in days of, you know, how you say, civilizations of yore. You know, someone's like, if he's your friend, he's my friend, or, you know, that loyalty, and if someone in the family is being bothered by someone else, and that person who's bothering becomes, unfavorable in the minds of everyone in the family, and all these kind of things like that, you don't really see now. Again, it's everybody for themselves more. But this kind of thing of where there's that strong emotional bond, and that's actually the reason for doing something, right? Mother Nanda Baba, when Krishna said, you know, don't do this Indra Yagya, do something for Govardhan Hill, just because it would please Krishna, Nanda Baba did it. Right? Simple. You know, it's his pleasure. But then there was a doubt. What about this and that? Oh, don't worry about it. And then he explained, you know, the more shastric or metaphysic or, you know, philosophical elements. But it's because Krishna wanted, then that's good enough. So that's actually what everything's trying to tell us. But since we have doubts on these, you know, levels of anamoy, pranamoy, manamoy, vigyanamoy, like this, therefore the Shastra gives us all these technical points, reasons, techniques, and everything to match everything. A philosophy for each level and a technique for each level. And then accordingly, then we will be attracted to those and then engage those from the Lord. But because they are the Lord, then those externals will fall away and we'll be left with the Lord. So they're not incompatible with the Gaudiya Vaishnav purpose. At the same time, as if you get distracted by them, then they can get in the way. Does that make sense? Okay. So we'll end here and then we'll continue if anyone wants to have any further questions after a few minutes. Rantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Samadita Bhaktivinoda ki, Janya Jai Gopur Devanam. Yeah.
lot I can say about that, but I've been asked to worship Radha Krishna. It's already Ganesh Temple, and now we have Radha Krishna. And I want to establish more kind of worship, standard of worship.
Yeah, maybe after the question.
Okay, it might be an extended one. Maybe it's some other time.
Otherwise, you can see there, but probably in more detail, you probably don't want to come to Janani.
Okay.
Just hope he's better at home, actually. I know more technical than Temple.
There's some kind of questions
that I have to discuss.
What is the interface of interaction?
Interface
between the material and the spiritual.
What's the interface between the material and spiritual? Okay. So the question is this. On interface, what's the interface between the material and spiritual? In this, we've been talking this technical point. So basically, it's the Virat Purush, it's the Lord Himself, the universal form. Because the Lord, He is the energies that actually make the material energy work. And so, to get from the material to the spiritual, spiritual means the Lord and His pastimes. So, when the material is dealt with as the Lord's material pastimes, means His pastimes in the material world, or the pastimes of creating, maintaining, destroying the material world, then that's the bridge that connects the two. So the Lord is the connection. He's the interface. Yes, Paramatma is there, but here what we're meaning is Paramatma in that He's entered everything, He's between everything, so everything that's functioning in the material world is actually Him. So seeing that in connection with Him, how He likes it to be seen, then that connects us to the spiritual. Right? But it's how He likes it to be seen, not how we like to see it. Does that make sense? Any other question?
Could you explain a little more about this process you spoke about, dismantling and then dovetailing?
Dismantling and dovetailing.
Yeah, attachments. And then how would one understand what Krishna would like in terms of dismantling and dovetailing?
Okay, dismantling and dovetailing, what would Krishna like in the way of dismantling and dovetailing? So dismantling or deconstruction means that you know how it's constructed, right? It means if you want to deconstruct, first you learn construction, right? Like they say in grammar, you learn what are the elements of a sentence and how to construct a sentence. Then once you know that, you can then take an already made sentence and deconstruct it, right? Back to what it is. What are its parts? What are the parts of speech? Why they've been put together that way? What is actually trying to be gotten across by the author of this sentence? Does that make sense? So that's why so much emphasis is put on creation. Because if creation is there, then you can deconstruct. Does that make sense? So deconstruction means that you understand that whatever activities and attachments and motives you have actually aren't what you think they are. Right? You know what I'm saying? Is that you're attached to, let's say, a family member. Let's just say, just pulling anything out of the air, let's say like a son, maybe, you know, like that. So, for us, that attachment, that interaction is very real. And the tendency will be, it will keep us entangled in the material world, because that's what it's done for, you know, unlimited lifetimes up to now. And it must have kept us very distracted, because we're again involved in it, and we desire it, and we like interacting with it. Does that make sense? So, therefore, it continues. So deconstruction means you apply this adhyatmika adhidaitika. This is one method, adhyatmika adhidaitika adhibhautika. So that means actually the sun is the soul. But it's not just the soul. I'm interested in the gross, the interactions with the gross and subtle body. That's actually what you call, you can't say you're parent of the soul, God's parent of the soul. So if we want to taste parental rasa, we have to get into the external, which means the gross and subtle bodies. Right? Does that make sense? We're not the source of the soul, so we can't claim parental rasa. So we want to taste parental rasa, but God's the source. He can taste it, but we can't, because we're not the source of the soul. So therefore, we have to take our attachment to, or the need for, parental interaction to the gross and subtle body. Right? That's our option. So now, so that's actually not the living entity. Right? So even though we claim we're interacting with the living entity, we're not. So what we're doing is we're interacting with the adipotic, which is the body and the mind. Right? And that's being controlled by the adidaivic, by the demigod in control of that, the gross and subtle bodies. Right? There's so many demigods, one's in control of the eyes, one the nose, one the, so they're all there. So actually what's happening is there's a soul there that has the same interest that you do. It's close enough to make a match that you put together. Right? It's never going to be exact, but it's close enough to make it work. Right? Then, by their independent desire to taste being parented, and someone to taste being the parent, then the demigods, the controlling deities, the adidaivic deities, then they arrange all the situations and the interactions of the gross and subtle body that the parent then thinks is the child, and the child also then thinks is them. Does that make sense?
So compounded
It's not so much, it means you deconstruct it and then you can put it together into, means the intelligence separates into categories and sees similarities between categories. That's what intelligence does. So you have to use both in deconstruction. Right? It means both have to be used. But the main thing is you're taking apart, though you're seeing some, you're connecting, you're taking it apart and then connecting that part to something else.
So in the situation of the mother with the son of attachment, does that then start to adopt it and themselves because you have the other person?
That's okay. So now you dovetail it by helping the other person. Okay, so yes, but what does that mean, helping the other person? Because you have to be very careful that in wanting to help, you don't fall into the same point that you were in before the deconstruction. So is the actual help a maintenance of the gross and subtle body? Is that the real help? That is the adibhotic focus of the soul in the child's body and the soul in the parent's body. But it's actually nothing to do with either of them. It's simply the field in which the two of them want to taste material interaction. Material rasa. Does that make sense? So, benefiting that only, then you can't say it's devotional service. Otherwise, the 6 billion people on this planet, all of them had a mother, all of them were nourished, that's why they're still alive today. So does that mean we got 6 billion devotees, you know, fired up, hardcore devotees on this planet? No. So if you look at it, anything you do for your child, you know, you feed them, you bathe them, you clothe them, you take care of them when they feel bad, you make arrangements for them, you educate them. Whatever you may do that is in your value system that you want to benefit them by, everybody else is doing exactly the same thing. Even the dogs are doing. Right? The tigress trains the cubs how to hunt. Right? In the beginning, she just feeds them. She goes out, catches something, brings something back that's quite dead, and then they all eat. But after they get a little bit bigger, and their coordination is better, she brings it back half dead. And so then because they want to eat, they first go to, you know, eat the thing, and then it reacts. Not enough to create any trouble, but enough that it's not dead. So then, in this way, she trains them how to kill the living entity. Then after that, then they get bigger and they figure out, then they can help the mother go hunting. You know what I'm saying? So it's like that. The hunter comes along, then the mother gets worried about the tiger cubs, and she takes them off in an area where the hunter won't see them. So whatever is going on in human society, the desires and the experiences are tasted in all 8,400,000. So it's nothing unique, and you can't call any one of that devotional service. That's the mistake. Big mistake. So what is the devotional service is that those activities are connected to Krishna. That's the service. Anything else is not service. That you fed your kid is not service. It's service, but not spiritual. Everybody feeds kids. At least they're supposed to.
Then bring us to a basic question. What is the soul?
No, that's...
The nature.
The nature of the
soul. What does it mean? Like we say water. The very nature of the water is liquidity.
Yeah, so the nature of the soul is Satchitananda, eternity, knowledge, and bliss. So that it wants to interact with living entities, that's because of the bliss. Right? That's what it wants to gain. That it does act, that's the chit. You know, it means the knowledge potency, because knowledge means activities. Right? And that they exist means that you expect that the relationships and activities you perform are going to continue. So that's inherent in the living entity. No one wants to die. Everyone wants to be happy. And they want that their activities were going to further that happiness. So that's inherent in the soul. That's the symptoms that you can see in the soul. Right? But so that means you have to connect it. So how do you connect that? How do you connect that the child is upset and you sit next to them, hold them, and stroke their head? That's what you're supposed to do. That's the nature. But how is that devotional service? So this is where the question lies. How are you connecting? Just to say, it's very easy. Right? Any parent will just off the top of their tongue say, yes, I'm engaging my child in devotional service. And the sentiment we respect. But when push comes to shove and you ask them to detail it, basically other than prasad and putting on some tilak and taking him to the temple, like that, engaging a chant, that's it. But is that why you became a parent? You became a parent to see that someone took a bath, put on tilak, chanted the japa, and went to the temple. Right? That's called a temple commander. You have a child so that you can feed them, clothe them, bathe them, take care of them when they're sick, find that happiness that they interact with you when they're happy, that they're dependent upon you, that they need you. That's why you had a child. Not to put tilak on somebody. That is easy. Why go through all that trouble just to get someone to put on tilak? Right? Imagine if you spent, 2 years you don't sleep when the child's first born. Now, if you put in that many hours out on the street preaching, how many people would you have putting on tilak? Right? And after 2 years of taking care of this kid, does it put on tilak? No. Right? So, you understand? So this is what deconstruction is you actually separate what is the mundane motherly need and actually what is the devotional service, what is the dovetailing. But unless you can deconstruct it, you can't tell. Otherwise, the mind, because it's samas, it'll just put things together. And yes, it's done. My kid has tilak on, he chants Hare Krishna, he takes prasad, he comes with me to the temple, it's done. But that is nothing to do with the reason. Or it may be a part, but a very small part of why you had that child. Because when you're sitting there and it has no clothes on and you're breastfeeding it, where's the tilak, where's the temple, where's the chanting, where's the... You understand? So that's what deconstruction is you actually separate it and you figure out that this is all just, you know, completely not the soul. And I become very entangled. I identify I'm a parent, but actually I'm not. The modes of nature are doing this. The universal form and his expansions as the devatas, they're running all this. And simply I'm tapping into it and trying to squeeze some satisfaction out of this. Alright? Does that make sense? So that's what the deconstruction, it wakes you up to actually, what am I connecting to Krishna and what am I not? Right? Then comes the dovetailing. Right? But unless this first part's done, the second part won't be complete, because due to our false ego, we'll always finesse it. You know, we'll always think we're doing a great job like that. No one really wants to get into this conversation. It means I can get away with it because I'm sitting here and, you know, and you're you know, therefore listening. But if I went personally to you and started telling you that, you know, your relationship with the kid is completely mundane, I'd probably be in for a very stiff fight. Okay? You know? Does that make sense? So now the dovetailing means, okay, I have all these needs. You know, I want to be there holding my kid's head when they're barfing into the toilet. Okay. So how does that fit? What is there? What's actually going on? That's where the universal form comes in. Because it's that potency of that being sick, someone there taking care and all that, those interactions are going on. In other words, that situation of that person being in that situation, there is a matching parental or friendship or servitorship relationship that goes with that. And those energies flow towards each other anyway. It's all going on. Right? Now it's just a matter of when we desire it, then the demigods in charge arrange that we happen to tap into that energy that's already happening. Okay? Does that make sense? So now, then the thing to do is, okay, what does the scriptures, what does the tradition, you know, that's given by the you know, the acharyas, what do they say are the ways in which we perform all these parental functions with the children? What is appropriate? Because otherwise, we can do anything we want. But then you'll get some other result. You can't be doing an activity that's non-devotional, and it's not actually a devotional motive, and claim you'll get a devotional result from it. Right? It means you perform it as devotional service, you get a spiritual result. You perform it not, you won't. It's simple. It's very direct. It's not a matter of false ego or that. It's a matter of just what is being connected. So that's why then the scriptures say, what is the parent, what is the nature of the parent, how they should deal. What is the nature of a child, how should they deal. Then what is the interaction? Once you understand those two things, then you can understand what is the interaction between a parent and a child. Until you know it as a parent, until you know it as a child, how do you know what's the relationship between a parent and a child? Does that make sense? Like you see people, they're not necessarily responsible towards their children. So then, how would you, then you would, technically they're not parents. Legally you can say they're parents, and biologically you can prove they're parents. But are they actually parents? Right? If I give you an apple, and you bite into it, it looks like an apple, you know, and everything, has the color, but you bite into it, there's absolutely no taste of an apple. Would you call it an apple? Right? We could say, yes, this is an apple according to the dictionary definition, because it doesn't say, you know, the taste. It doesn't say, you know, this a particular fruit that tastes like an apple. No, it says this, you know, funny fruit that kind of has these different colors and like that. Does that make sense? So, therefore, it's its quality of rasa, of parentness, that is based on natural manifestations, right? Because if you take what it is that every parent wants to do with your child, it's all the same for everyone. The particular detail may be different, but the experience they want to get is exactly the same. Otherwise, why would you call it parent? Right? Say again? Yes, he wants him to be a devotee. So therefore, what are you doing that makes them a devotee? That's the point. Is it just the tilak? Is it just going to Mangalartik? Is that enough? Like that. Otherwise, look around. You're a community member. How many are committed devotees? On their own. It means you get credit for having made them into a devotee when they're 16 years of age and they're performing devotional activities on their own, determination. Before that, you don't get credit for making a devotee. It's potential. And then when they do, then you get all that backlog credit. But if they turn 16 and they didn't become a devotee, then where's the credit? You know what I'm saying? It doesn't sound good. It's very bad. 16 years, so much money, so much endeavor. I don't want to feel like an idiot. So therefore, it's one of those topics that's just finessed. It's just dropped. It's an area you do not enter into. Right? Nice. But the problem is then we should also be just comfortable with the result. Kid didn't, okay, I tried. I didn't do a great job. Kid didn't become a devotee. They're on their own. I'll get back into devotional service full time now. And I'll move on. How many parents do that? So, therefore, then the need to make all that work. So, what is it? How are you training them? What is your value system that you're doing it? You know what I'm saying? Is everything in your life connected? Because they're just going to pick up what you do. You're going to parent how your parents parented you. Or that environment in which you grew up, that others who dealt in a parental way, that's what you are. It's not going to be different. Right? A hippie from Hawaii is going to raise the kid like a hippie. Right? You know, someone from traditional Ivy League families from the Northeast are going to raise the kids like that. Indians will raise the kids like that. You know what I'm saying? So it's you're going to raise them the way you were raised. So then the question comes is that enough? How does Krishna like to be raised? How does he like to be dealt with? That's what the whole Varnashram system is. That's what the whole system of the etiquette and everything is so that you do things the way God likes them to be done. That's when the dovetailing comes in. Is that the way you raise your kid is how Krishna, if he was your kid, how he'd like to be raised. Because the elements that are going on are the universal form. So technically speaking, what you call your child is actually the universal form, is Krishna. It's not the soul. You think it's the soul. You think it's the body, but it's actually the potency is the universal form. So you're actually dealing with Krishna. But because you don't recognize as Krishna, and that therefore it doesn't act like that. But you understand these are Krishna's potencies, then it's Krishna's potency. How would Krishna like to be dealt with? Then you start getting into proper dovetailing. You know what I'm saying? Okay. Let us say, where do you put the mat, the towel, when you get out of the shower? Where is it? Just outside, right? Now, you've just gone to the toilet. So now, before you go into the shower. Now, so you either, depending upon your, inclination, you've either had a toilet you stood on, you know, by squatting on it, or one that you stood next to, that's also quite dirty. Right? So that means your feet are dirty. Did you step on that towel before you went into the shower? If you did, that towel is dirty. So then if you take a shower and you come out and you step on that towel again to dry your feet, you've created a very nice, clean, and controlled environment for your kid, and it's not, you know, unsophisticated and gross and all that. But it's not clean to Krishna's standard. Krishna wouldn't want to step on that towel, so then why is it there? Or why is it put in such a way that you have to step on it to get in the shower? Why can't it be on half of the place? So the empty place you step on to go into the shower, and then you step on the towel on the way out. Name me one house like that. One. One. In thousands and thousands of devotees. Does anybody ever think of that? No. Yes, ones from top class South Indian Brahmin families might, who follow the tradition, maybe. But other than that, no. And if you bring this up, you're a fanatic. So therefore, where's the dovetailing? Therefore, you're just enjoying the kid, and a little bit you're connecting to Krishna, important, most important, but the problem is your attachment to the kid has not been connected to Krishna, really. So that's why Krishna would not want to step on that tower. And are you training your kid about that? Does your kid wash their feet after they go into the bathroom? Do you wash your feet after you go into the bathroom? Say what you like. Oh, I didn't, you know, touch the toilet. But it's dirty around there. Take water, put it in the jug, pour it onto a surface, dry surface. Watch how far it splatters. So if you think you're using that toilet, it's like, you could say maybe 97% of the water is going to the toilet. The small percent is going all in a big radius around that toilet. That floor is dirty. And even if you wear your magic plastic shoes that you put on, plastic becomes dirty by contact. So that means you've come in with clean feet, touched the magic shoes, your feet are dirty. Then you've gone and used the toilet, and somehow these magic shoes are going to keep your feet clean. And not only that, then you have the socks, which have picked up now a portion of that 3% of the urine that's flying here and thither. And then you walk that all over your house. And then you call your kitchen clean, your DD room clean. And, you know, like that. Then you wonder why your kid's crying and being disturbed and there's nothing disturbing them, because there's all these subtle elements that are around that can come because your house is filthy. And so you're claiming that you're working for your child's good, but no, you're bringing all these nasty elements in your house because your house is filthy and they're bothering your child. And that's why he's crying. Right? You put the little dot, okay, that's for outside people, that's for the humans, but the dot's not for the subtle living entities. That's cleanliness. So how is that engaged? It's not. It should be. That's why these rules are there. But we have this nice little thing of fanatic, and we just chant Hare Krishna, and all these nice little packed things, so that basically devotees can just avoid all the rules and regulations that are meant, how they can connect themselves to Krishna. So basically is, how much I'm doing, am I good enough, and that's all. Hey, you leave me alone. Give me space. Great. That's all right if you're walking in the street in New York. But you want to go back to Godhead? Or you want to stay there on, you know, how do you say, 57th and Lexington, you know? You know, what do you want? So that's why these chapters are here. That's what they're for. So the point is, a grihastha has the most attachments. That means they have the most things they could engage in Krishna service. But instead, they just use it as a burden. Therefore, the verses are there. It's just a dark well. It's this, because that's what it is. How long did it take to put on that tilak? Then you went to Mangalarti. Then you went to class, chanted a little japa. Add all that up, what's left. Right? And if the temple president is saying, be there for all the things and this and that, the grihastha starts freaking out. Where is that quality time with the family? When can they interact with their kid? Right? Does that make sense? And you'll see that will win. Or you'll have the grihastha pushes through and then the kid's on the turvy case. Right? So then how do you find a balance? I have to be involved with the family, that's why I have them. It's really stupid to have the family and not be involved with them. That's irresponsible. That's stupid. Because then that just means you're going to have another family later to work out your need for a family. Because you have one. Otherwise, if you didn't need one, why? Well, then you wouldn't have one. But that's it. You have a family, don't take care of them, don't interact with them. That basically, you know, draw a little line and underneath it says, next birth. You know? Because you're going to have one again. Because you haven't engaged it. So that's the point, is how do you get rid of it? By engaging it. right? We're hungry. So what do? We engage the hunger by tasting prasad. We satisfy ourselves with the prasad. The taste is there by prasad. The nice smell is there as prasad. It looks nice as prasad. Right? The atmosphere in which you serve, it's there, it's nice, it's prasad. So in that way we engage all these human needs in the Lord's service. So why all these other ones wouldn't be there, right? That's why Garbhodan is there, right? There are parents who don't follow Garbhodan and think they're perfectly fine. My kids turned out all right. They say exactly that. I didn't do Garbhodan, my kids turned out all right. What's the big deal? So then that means then your sex had nothing to do with Krishna. Absolutely nothing. You say, oh, I'm making devotees. What do you mean you're making devotees? You make bodies in which devotees can attend. But, you know, that the demigods are arranging, and then the universal form, the Adi Daivik and the Adi Bhautik, are arranging that. You're just desiring. So what's your credit? What did you do? How did you further that? How did you make it? How was that great service? Your orgasm was such great service to Krishna? Tell us how. We're waiting to hear. But no, your false ego will get in the way, and this will immediately start a big, huge fight, and somebody who won't talk to you for years. And then we're supposed to accept blindly that this is all, you know, oh, the others are blind. You know, the biggest blindness is just the finessing of the Grihastha Ashram. That's one of the biggest cover-ups in our society. It's like that. Just the false ego of the men and women, just that they're fine and everybody else is stay out of their face. So, yes, if it's just a matter of, you know, avoid the family, it's all Maya, yes, that you don't have to listen to. That's nonsense. But this thing of that you have attachments, figure out how those attachments connect to Krishna and connect them. That no one can say is Maya. That no one can claim is, oh, you know, you renunciates are, you know, getting in the way and making all our trouble is all because of you guys. That means you don't even understand what Krishna consciousness is. Philosophy like that. You understand, okay, I'm soul, I'm servant of God. Those are essentials. That's the major thing. But actually how you're going to operate and go back to Godhead, where's the chance? It'll take a little while. Going to take longer than you would actually like it to. You know, we're being given the option of one lifetime. That's special, right? You know what I'm saying? So if you don't engage those, where's next? Heavenly planets. And then on the heavenly planets, what are you going to be doing? What do they do? What are they doing out in their little parks? All the nice 16-year-old boys and girls. And how is that connected to Krishna? And you're there how many years? Shortest heavenly planets generally is 10,000. Some of them go for hundreds of thousands. Or millions. You're devotees, so you'd be there a long time. So you're just going to be millions of years just wasting as a demigod, just enjoying the senses. So then, how is that service to Krishna? Does that make sense? You get the connection I was making there? Krishna says, if you perform devotional service, you fall away before you really become situate, stable, then you go to heavenly planets. Right? If you became stable, you take birth into devoted family of devotees. So that means someone who was actually quite advanced takes family birth into the family of devotees. And then what do we do with them? Make them into Westerners. Like that. Is that the reason? Let us say you are, you know, advanced in devotional service, you're situated, you're doing nicely, and that. But somehow or another, some little attachment, you know, you were the one that thought about that Rasgula that Prabhupada talked about, so you had to come back, and, you know, and your mothers, you know, or fathers, expert, they make all the Rasgulas for the Sunday feast, you know, they're famous in the society for the Rasgulas. Okay. Now, looking at it from your perspective now, would you want them to train you up like a Westerner, or would you want them to train you, you know, how to get rid of that attachment to that Rasgula? And what are parents doing? Like that. So that's the point. Parent means if you actually understand what a parent is, as a devotee, you're given a soul that was a seriously situated devotee before. Otherwise, if not, they weren't so serious. They're born in the family of religious or pious families, not devotees. They're born in a nice Brahmin family or a nice practicing, you know, family of the aristocracy, either the nobility or the aristocracy. That's why they're there. Yes. They'll get a devotee with more attachments. It means the point is it's not that devotees don't have all kinds of attachments. It means thing is what we have to put aside. We have this nice puritanical concept of advancement, which basically means you're advanced or you're a nonsense. Basically, that's the, you know, American worldview. You know, you're it or you're not. You got it or you don't. And there's nothing in between. Right? This mamby-pamby kind of European and Asian thing is, you know, everybody's, you know, has their bad days and, you know, we respect what good qualities they have and finesse the ones that they don't. That's definitely not American. It's all or nothing. Right? So then this idea is that 60% is considered advanced. If you're 60%, if you're situated, that's called nishta. So that's advanced. 60%, you're moved forward. You're fixed in devotional service. So what that 40% is could be anything. Could be attached into any of the, you know, breaking of any of the regulative principles or any position or power, influence, or, you know, any of the six opulences. So, depending upon what it is, then that's what you get. Or, and cultured, they can be, in one sense, advanced, but not cultured. Because the point is devotional service is such, which aspect you operate, it develops there. Other ones may lag behind. You know what I'm saying? You have someone who's really into chanting their japa, and they're really good at chanting, and everybody will respect them for that. But they're a terror in the prasad hall. You know, nothing's good enough, and this and that, and you get indigestion if you sit next to them. So that's going to be their weakness. If they take birth again, that's going to be their problem. You know, nothing their mother cooks will be right. You know? So the point is depending on what it is, you're going to get that aspect of purity. So they may be advanced one thing, they may don't know philosophy, or culturally they may be weak. You know? Does that make sense? And you do find, are devotees killing themselves? Do devotees ever commit suicide? Okay, so how does a ghost get from a ghost body back into human form? Illicit sex. So that means any child born out of wedlock was a ghost. That's their right. It doesn't mean that they weren't a devotee. You understand? So we have this nice thing, is that it's just like, I think as Vidyananda Maharaj once said, it says, you see a cute little 5-year-old, I see someone who 5 years old, 5 years ago was a 95-year-old man. So that means all those needs and desires are still all there. Otherwise, why did they take birth? But devotional service is in a separate category. So that remains, but what is left of their impurities is still there. If that can be recognized, we can recognize in the self. So basically what happens is we can't recognize in ourself, we can't appreciate it in others. So in other words, someone who stands on his soapbox and is so moralistic, and anybody makes any mistake anywhere and they want to drag them down and all that, that you've just seen a person who cannot be introspective, who is afraid of looking at their own faults and all that. So they stand on their, you know, their natural habit of moral principles that they picked up from their parents. Nothing to do with devotional service. Can be engaged very nicely in devotional service, but morality is not devotional service. So morality is the platform, I said, of economics. Economics is the platform of the bourgeois. The bourgeois is the American culture. The modern culture is the bourgeois culture, which is business culture, which is economics. Therefore, why I talk of morality, because if I was talking to Indians, I would talk on Dharma. That's where they get bent out of shape. You know, it's religious, and it's the right thing to do, and that's where they get all caught up and can't get into devotional service. That's their obstacle. like that, or jnana, I guess some must call it, by the impersonalism they can't, like that. But the Westerners is generally sense gratification and extended sense gratification. These are their two stumbling blocks. You know, it's like either they're doing it, or if they're not doing it, they're complaining about everybody else who is. Right? Does that make sense? And somehow or another, by doing that, you figure you're really doing something for Krishna. That's a mistake. Right? Does that make sense? I have a computer. I have an email server. I have fingers. I can push buttons, and I can press the send. And I feel I'm doing some serious service for Krishna because I'm professing an ism. But since when Prabhupada talks so much about ism, since when does an ism have anything to do with devotional service? If it does, then it has to be connected to devotional service as Krishna says, not as we say. You know, as left-wing, conservative, you know, liberal, you know, intellectuals. But what's that got to do with Krishna and devotional service? That's our viewpoint. That's our perspective. Nice, but what has that got to do with devotional service? Right? We're vegetarian because the animals, you know, like that. Okay, that's a nice sentiment. It's good. It shows some finer sentiment. But we're vegetarians because Krishna's vegetarian. That's why we're vegetarian. You know? Because it probably points out, pigeons are vegetarian. Like there's a lot of living entities in the animal kingdom that are vegetarian. But they're animals. You know, so does that make sense? So it's because it's Krishna. So that particular viewpoint we have to gain. But the things that I've been saying over the last half an hour, any of that could start an immense, immense fight. Immense fight. If it's brought up in the company of those who don't like being introspective or are too overwhelmed by all these externals of bureaucratic bourgeois platform. Like that. It's a reality. That's the only reason. I'm only saying these things not to, express political opinions. We're expressing this from the platform to make us aware of what we're involved in and how we can be tricked by the material energy because we think it's okay. And that's her trick. Right? She makes us think it's okay. You know, it's just like she can make us think, the super soul is us. Right? That's how she crafts us, the yogis. It's the last snare of Maya. So she can also make it that I would be a social activist if I wasn't a devotee. So my position as a social activist is devotional service. That's the Maya. It can be devotional service if you actually do connect it. But just to find fault in other devotees, since when is that listed as one of the... Is that one of the 26 qualities of a devotee? Has Rupa Goswami ever enumerated that as one of the 64 items of devotional service? From my particular mundane, non-Vedic perspective, to find fault in others, you know, is one of the important devotional activities? No, kutinati, or fault-finding, and diplomacy, is considered the worst of all the anarthas. So, we're taking the worst of an anartha and spin-doctoring it, you know. What is it? What's the name? It's something Reese, or, you know, in America, they do all the spin doctoring for America. I mean, it's like, you know, we got them looking like small-timers. Right? They're just spin doctoring that America just, you know, walked in, took over a country, and then, you know, saying that it was, you know, we did it for their own good. So, great. But we're taking just mundane needs of our own that we would be doing anyway and then saying their devotional service. We're not saying it can't be. That's what I'm saying. It's fine. That would be what you're doing. Great. Engage that in Krishna's service. Figure it out, signs of it, how it works, and engage it. Why waste? You know? Because they're very simple. Right? Krishna likes things pure. He's the supreme pure. Therefore, he likes things pure. Right? So therefore, your body, your mind, your words, the surroundings, you know, your paraphernalia, all these can be pure. And you're doing it because you want to be pure for serving Krishna. I cook for Krishna, I go to the temple for Krishna, I chant, I touch my beads, I touch the devotees, I don't... So therefore, that's why I'm very careful to, you know, not get toothpaste all over when I'm brushing my teeth, and when I shave, I don't leave all the hairs, and after I take a shower, I don't leave hairs, you know, gorilla hairs in the bathtub, and all these different things like that. So, it's easily connected, but if you don't connect it, it's not connected. That's the point. So just saying it's connected is you should know how it's connected. You should be able to say that. My house is very clean and orderly and tidy because Krishna likes things clean. Right? Then all my cleanliness in my house is connected. It looks nice because Krishna likes things to look nice. Beauty is the first opulence. Therefore, my house looks beautiful. Right? I'm going to make it beautiful anyway, but now I'll make it beautiful according to what Krishna likes as beauty. Right? Does that make sense? So, therefore, elements that, you know, would be traditionally thought, I'll do that. But if not, at least I'll do it because I know this is all I know, this is the aesthetic taste I have, and so I make it beautiful for Krishna. Then it's connected. It's that simple. But it means it should be that consuming. That we're always absorbed like that. That's, then body, mind, and words are engaged. So we only bring it, make it such a, means my presentation, we're only making it very big and possibly, I don't know what the word would be, but just making it look as a big deal just so that we'll note it. Because it's a small thing, then the pragmatic American viewpoint, generally small things are not important. You know, it's, you know, you just get the job done. You know? But here we're pointing out is your whole day is just full of little details. That's the whole, you know, day. Everything you do, you know, you say you like it that way. Why do you like it that way? There's a reason. You know what I'm saying? The colors you wear, the things that you wear, how you put them on, how you present yourself, all these are stuff that are very important to you. Otherwise, you wouldn't be doing them. So, what is it? What is the quality behind it? Why those colors? Why those things? Why all these different things? Does that make sense? So, that is being done so that you connect it to Krishna. Right? And it doesn't mean it has to change. No, the first thing to change is the consciousness. That's probably makes it very clear. In this, it's not that, oh, I can't do that because I can't follow all the Vedic things. No. The point is first connect the consciousness on the principle. Then by doing that with time, one, it's already connected, so you're getting devotional benefit. And two, with time, just naturally the modes of passion and ignorance go, and so you prefer more sattvic things. Right? The Prabhupada's thing wasn't that, okay, the man's in his three-piece suit at his karmic job, doing his, you know, living his lifestyle and how he lives, and that's all got to change to take up devotional service. No. Understand your relationship, who you are, your relationship with God, who God is, your relationship with Him, and chant Hare Krishna. That's where you should start. They're chanting Hare Krishna, that's successful. Not the vegetarian were successful. No, they chant Hare Krishna were successful. They chant after a while, then naturally sadhu sangha becomes important, so therefore devotees are vegetarian, they become vegetarian. Right? If we made them a vegetarian, but they're not devotees, nice, it's pious, it's good, okay, great. But we haven't heard that mundane piety ever gets anyone back to Godhead. But it's pious people who surrender, so okay, it's in an indirect way, not bad, maybe you get enough of that, maybe one day you will surrender. But the point is it doesn't necessarily mean there are dogs on the heavenly planets. So you have to have some pious credits to be a dog on the heavenly planets rather than a dog, you know, in the back streets of, you know, some Mexican village, you know, where, you know, you might be dinner next. You know, so like that, does that make sense? So it's a matter of, it's not enough. So it's very simple. You just connect it. It works. But at the same time, is it should be as complete as possible. In other words, how much your intellect and your sophistication is, to that degree it should be applied. Does that make sense? You're not very sophisticated, don't worry about it. You're not that intelligent, then just keep to the basics, because that's all that your mind is fully absorbed anyway. But if there's something more, you know, I mean, I can only say, I can say that there's, I could say this. I know one lady in the movement that is an actual bona fide frump, and actually doesn't care what she looks like. And just because she's so absorbed in the service, I only know one. And everybody else that have that sophistication of dressing nicely, or this, or the colors, or this, or how they drape it, or so many things like this. This one doesn't. It's just, this is what's done. They put on their clothes and they go do the service. I know one. So how is that sophistication being used by everybody else in Krishna's service? You know, all they know is that I put on the sari, I'm a lady, I put on the sari, I go and I do my service first. That's it. So it's fully engaged. But the rest of it, how is that engaged? So are we dressing how Krishna likes it to be dressed? Are we doing, are we good? So to that degree we're sophisticated, how is that sophistication in line with what Krishna wants? You know? You know? Give a funny example. An earring is considered to be an ornament of the cheek. We always say it's of the ear, but it brings out the cheek, because when it moves, you notice the cheek. You don't notice the ear. You ever notice the ear from an earring? No. You notice the cheek. So when an earring is that long, comes down to the collarbone, how is that an ornament of the cheek? Right? Do you ever see traditional Indian jewelry go past the cheek? No. These are little things that I'm talking about. So you like wearing nice, fancy, you know, your things, fine. But keep it within the tradition. Right? Because that's what Krishna likes. Because it's an ornament of the cheek, not of the collarbone. Collarbone's supposed to be fleshy, but, you know, you're anorexic because you don't eat. So, therefore, you don't have a fleshy collarbone either. So it's brought attention to your collarbone, which is not actually very attractive. So it actually wasn't the right thing to do. Better stick to the studs or something a little shorter. Plus, your cheeks are pretty thin also. So, yeah, just stick to the ears. You know, keep the studs. You know, that would be a better connection. Is that okay?
Such a crucial issue, how to bring up children. And Prabhupada did give a few instructions, but not very detailed. And so there seems to be a vacuum.
There's a vacuum because we don't look for it.
So where is that scripture? Is it available in the...
Well, we're looking at one right now. Srimad Bhagavatam. I just explained from here how to do it.
Specifically about how to bring up children. Is there such a scripture?
The point is if you know the principles that you're dealing on, then you're trying to make them into a devotee. What does that mean? Devotee means that they themselves are committed to devotional service. So that means you have to be committed. So in other words, if you can get yourself to commit to devotional service, you'll be able to get your kid to commit. You can't get your kid to do something you can't do. Right? It's just like this. The temple president hates washing pots. He'll always have a problem finding someone to wash pots. But if the temple president likes to wash pots, but because he's busy with the temple president duties, he doesn't have the time to, he'll always be able to find someone to wash the pots. Because it's his value, he likes it. Therefore, others will be inspired to do it. So if you don't like to chant, your kids won't chant. You don't like to go to monk, they won't go. You don't like to dress, you know, as a devotee, they won't dress. So, in other words, on their own, once they get past the basic thing, they can go beyond you, which is, we always hope. We always hope that the children will go quicker than us. But their foundation of how they'll perceive and function will be what is actually our value system in reality, not what we project. You know, we're at Mangalarti, they're dancing and being the pure devotee, but if the kid wasn't there, we wouldn't do it. Then they're never going to dance. They're going to think, how come they're not dancing? I'm dancing. No, you're dancing because they're there. You're not dancing because you want to dance with Krishna. You're dancing because you think this is the right thing to do, to show them to set the right example so that your kid will dance with Krishna. Therefore, they don't dance. So that's the simplest thing, is you have your value, you have knowledge of devotional service, you contemplate it, you try to understand it, you practice it, and then those values that you gain from that practice, you explain them to your children. You do that, the other details will fall into place. So when you say there's a big vacuum, no, it's only details are there. The system's been given by Prabhupada. Same system you want to make a devotee, same system you want to cultivate anything. It's the same thing. Nourishment means that you give them something of value, right? But nowadays it's simply clothes and food. But nourishment should be you're nourishing the devotional creeper by training them in devotional service, giving them devotional service. That means you have it. You don't have it, how you get it? That's why you see is that in here we'll see so many grihasthas get married, and before they have the kids, then they'll sit for 60,000 years and do the meditation until they see the super soul and it becomes self-realized, then they'll have the kids. Right? In other words, we should be, we either, if we have the opulence, then we make that endeavor to become more Krishna conscious and situated in devotional service before we get married and have kids. But if we find that we're already married and have kids, then we're making that endeavor to become Krishna conscious. These are major things, you know. Because technique changes depending on time, place, and circumstance. Right? It's just like there's one book going around on, non-violent communication. But if you'll notice in there on chapter 11, after 10 chapters of explaining how the importance of non-violent communication, what's the 11th chapter on? Appropriate use of force. So, 11 chapters are there because people don't know the appropriate use of force. Therefore, the book focuses on the nonviolent communication, but the actual is balanced. You use nonviolent when it works. If it doesn't work, then you use force. But there's an appropriate way to use force that you actually get the result. So the point is how to get the result, not how to be nonviolent or how to be authoritative. No, the point is how to get the result. So all these isms of, you know, being nice and touchy-feely, great, but is the result there? Are the kids fixed in devotional service? Do they know where they're going? Do they have a direction in life? All the psychological studies of kids have shown that those families that have a tradition, follow the tradition, and expect and encourage their children to follow that tradition, those kids are the ones that had the least amount of trouble in their teenage years. Psychologists all admit this. They don't like it because they're all liberals. They don't like this conservative, that they can't handle that conservatism works, so they'll try to take it, spin doctor it to make it into their own. Because their ism is more important than actually the result. So that's the point. That's the problem. You're conservative, that's your point. Or you're liberal, that's your point. But the actual thing is what works. Situation A, conservatism works. Situation B, liberalism works. Right? You work your best to see that your kid doesn't get into situations that will get them into trouble. That's the conservative. And you push that. But if they do get into trouble, then you're liberal. It happens. Okay. I wasn't able to protect. I wasn't able to show all the things. These things happen. Okay. Now what are we going to do about it? But where it fails is the conservative implies that where he should be liberal. And the liberal is liberal in that situation, but where he should have been protecting the child, he's also liberal, therefore they fail. So both systems fail. So the point is this, what is the balance between the two? When are you liberal, when are you conservative? That's what we get from the scriptures. So that we see here. Right? Right? Diti, aditi. They didn't really have a proper attitude in wanting to have kids in certain occasions. So, the husband is presenting the conservative platform of what it should be, but the discussion itself, the wording, the tone of voice, is that of someone in a very liberal mind. Right? So in one case, he was able to convert that appropriately. In another case, he wasn't. So in one case, you ended up with the Marut, and the other one, you ended up Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha. Right? Like that. So, but he was, you know, in other words, that's the technique, so that's how it works. So if you can do that with a wife, you can raise a kid. You know, the whole thing is, oh, kids are the problem. No, taking care of the wife's the problem. You can take care of the wife, kids are easy. So people say, I can't raise the kids, probably means they don't know how to take care of women. You just take kids, intensify them immensely, and you get women. That's why women can deal with kids. Right? They can relate. Does that make sense?
Crazy folk.
Sorry. I'd like to, but it's kind of late. Like that. It's 10 o'clock. This is not supposed to be 11, but yes, thanks for doing that. But we can continue again next week. That's okay? No, that's it. Okay, stop here. Pranjaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Samavita Bhakti Vrindhi ki, 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 Vrindhi